to be, or not to be.
Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows and reaper drones of those who make outrageous fortunes from the suicide bomb of fossil fuel. Sacrifice zone for the 1% in their green zones.
To be or not to be, to be or not to be. To be or not to be,
to be engaged in this existential struggle.
To be or not to be,
between life on earth and an economic model, or to take arms against a rising sea of troubles, and by opposing them from the ground up.
By the axis of descent, on behalf of the 99%.
We'll take our power from the wind and sun,
and leave the oil in the ground.
Demand clean air and fresh clean water,
and leave the oil in the ground.
And we'll be singing, die, 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 capitalism must die. Fossil fuel has added far too good,
far too long.
But all things must pass, all things decay.
Starting today,
the lack of separation between state and corporation
is way past itself by day.
So die neoliberalism, miasma capitalism. Die, 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 die.
Yeah, all right. To be or not to be, that is the question facing us all. I know it is the Christmas holiday season, Hanukkah, Festivus, and many others. Solstice. Tomorrow's the solstice. It's a time to be with people we love, if we can, to focus on good things. And we all should do that. It's also the end of the year, and we're looking back, and boy, a lot has happened this year. So we're going to revisit the question of capitalism or the planet or the biosphere or stability that we've taken up on a number of occasions. I want to talk a little bit about this new book, Burning Up, A Global History of Fossil Fuel Consumption, and its author, Simon Pirani, who I just got in touch with. I hope to have him on today, but I guess he's taking care of his grandkids today. He lives in the UK, England, and just came out with an article on Truth Out, which I'll be quoting from, and he agreed to come on sometime in January, February, so we're looking forward to that. But, you know, it's a real thing what climate change is doing, not only to our planet and to island nations and to vulnerable communities and to our psyches. It's a very real thing. It's kind of like a seasonal affective disorder on, I was going to say steroids, that's kind of the thing people say, but I don't know what it's on. So yeah, another recent article came out a few days ago on the Huffington Post, headline, Solastalgia is the specific grief and anxiety caused by climate change. Scientists are just starting to understand what climate change is doing to our mental health. Mental health researchers around the world are taking notice of what people feel when the world they've always known changes gradually or suddenly from climate change. Some call it environmental grief, some call it solastalgia, a word coined for a feeling of homesickness when home changes around you. The American Psychological Association has released a lengthy report into solastalgia. So has the British medical journal The Lancet. Australian farmers report rising levels of depression as their drought-stricken lands blow away. An international group of climate scientists maintain a website entitled, Is This How You Feel? House of Commons committees have discussed it. Health Canada is exploring the topic. And this goes on. This is, again, just from December 13th, Huffington Post, Solastalgia is a specific grief and anxiety caused by climate change. Yeah, you know, it's a real downer, but avoiding the subject doesn't help. I'm going to read a little bit. I finally picked up a copy of This Changes Everything, the epic book of a few years ago by Naomi Klein, called, subtitled Capitalism Versus the Climate. So I'm here by myself. I'm Paul Rowland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. We started out with Dambert No Bacon and the Axis of Dissent with the To Be or Not to Be. Of course, he's formerly of the one of my favorite bands of all time, Chumbawamba, from the UK, the great anarchist collective. He lives in Upper Washington State now and has this new band that occasionally releases some stuff, The Axis of Dissent. He's been here on this show. He's been on KBOO several times. All right, I'm going to be talking about sort of the year in review. Again, Capitalism Versus the Climate, this new book, Burning Up, this article by the author Simon Pirani. And I just want to start out on the issue of facing up to reality. Meanwhile, each supercharged natural disaster produces new irony-laden snapshots of a climate increasingly inhospitable to the very industries most responsible for its warming. like the 2013 historic floods in Calgary that forced the head offices of the oil companies mining the Alberta tar sands to go dark and send their employees home. While a train carrying flammable petroleum products teetered on the edge of a disintegrating rail bridge, or the drought that hit the Mississippi River 1 year earlier, pushing water levels so low that barges loaded with oil and coal were unable to move for days. While they waited for the Army Corps of Engineers to dredge a channel, they had to appropriate funds allocated to rebuild from the previous year's historic flooding along the same waterway. Or the coal-fired power plants in other parts of the country that were temporarily shut down because the waterways that they draw on to cool their machinery were either too hot or too dry, or in some cases, both. And I'll just add that since this book was written, was it already 2014? Gosh, things go so fast these days. One could draw on many other examples, like the ones that Naomi Klein just did. Living with this kind of cognitive dissonance, she continues, is simply part of being alive in this jarring moment in history when a crisis we have been studiously ignoring is hitting us in the face, and yet we are doubling down on the stuff that is causing the crisis in the first place. I denied climate change for longer than I care to admit. Again, this is Naomi Klein speaking. I knew it was happening, sure. Not like Donald Trump and the Tea Partiers going on about how the continued existence of winter proves us all a hoax. And if you go on some climate Facebook groups, you'll see many people continuing to trumpet that line. But I stayed pretty hazy on the details and only skimmed most of the news stories, especially the really scary ones. Don't we all do that? Occasionally, or much of the time. I told myself the science was too complicated and that the environmentalists were dealing with it, and I continued to behave as if there was nothing wrong with a shiny card in my wallet attesting to my elite frequent flyer status. A great many of us engage in this kind of climate change denial. We look for a split second and then we look away, or we look but then turn it into a joke. Quote, more signs of the apocalypse. Which is another way of looking away. Or we look but tell ourselves comforting stories about how humans are clever and will come up with a technological miracle that will safely suck the carbon out of the skies or magically turn down the heat of the sun. And I parenthetically say another article that just came out, first ever sun dimming experiment will mimic volcanic eruption in attempt to reverse global warming. We may talk about that as well. Or we look but try to be hyper-rational about it. Quote, dollar for dollar, it's more efficient to focus on economic development than climate change, since wealth is the best protection from weather extremes, end quote. As if having a few more dollars will make much difference when your city is underwater, which is a way of looking away if you happen to be a policy wonk. Or we look but tell ourselves we are too busy to care about something so distant and abstract, even though we saw the water in the subways in New York City, and the people on the rooftops in New Orleans, or one could add sense to what happened in Houston, Puerto Rico, the American Southeast, and know that no one is safe, the most vulnerable least of all. And though perfectly understandable, this too is a way of looking away. Or we look but tell ourselves that all we can do is focus on ourselves, meditate and shop at farmers markets and stop driving, but forget trying to actually change the systems that are making the crisis inevitable, because that's too much bad energy and it will never work. And at first, it may appear as if we are looking, because many of these lifestyle changes are indeed part of the solution, but we still have one eye tightly shut. Or maybe we do look, really look, but then inevitably we seem to forget. Remember and then forget again. Climate change is like that. It's hard to keep it in your head for very long. We engage in this odd form of on-again, off-again ecological amnesia for perfectly rational reasons. We deny because we fear that letting in the full reality of this crisis will change everything, and we are right. We know that if we continue on our current path of allowing emissions to rise year after year, climate change will change everything about our world. Major cities will likely drown, ancient cultures will be swallowed by the seas, and there's a very high chance that our children will spend a great deal of their lives fleeing and recovering from vicious storms and extreme droughts. And we don't have to do anything to bring about this future. All we have to do is do nothing. Just continue to do what we're doing now, whether it's counting on a techno fix or tending to our gardens or telling ourselves we're unfortunately too busy to deal with it. And anyway, she goes on. That's the introduction to This Changes Everything, which I could ironically say hasn't really changed much either. So, as we know, there's been more superstorms, more megafires. I also want to focus on a number of reports that have been just coming out fast and furious. In August, researchers with the National Center for Climate Restoration and independent think tank in Australia issued a new report, What Lies Beneath the Understatement of Existential Climate Risk, which argued that the existential threats posed by the climate crisis have still not penetrated the collective psyche of humanity. I would argue that there really is no collective psyche of humanity, or even of a nation, hardly anymore, or even of the communities that have been destroyed by capitalism, which is part of what we have to do, is reconstruct the collective, which seems an impossible task in and of itself. So, also in August, the Swedish National Academy, where is that report that I'm looking for, issued the so-called Hothouse Earth study, which received widespread attention. Where is that study? I just had my hands on. But anyway, it argued that things are going much faster than anybody thought. I will read a little bit that when I come across it. So then, early October, major new report by the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which was founded, I think, in 1991 or so, the year before the Rio Earth Summit, which was also supposed to change everything, which kind of launched Al Gore on his trajectory toward getting a Nobel Prize. Oh, those were the days. So the authors of the IPCC study found that if greenhouse gas emissions continue at the current rate, the atmosphere will warm by as much as 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit, 1.5 degrees Celsius, above pre-industrial levels by 2040, inundating coastlines and intensifying droughts and poverty. Previous work had focused on estimating the damage if average temperatures were to rise by a larger number, 3.6 degrees, because that was the threshold scientists previously considered the most severe for the most severe effects of climate change. The new report, however, shows that many of those effects will come much sooner, at the 2.7 degree mark. Avoiding the most serious damage requires transforming the world economy within just a few years, said the authors, who estimate that the damage would come at a cost of $54 trillion. While they conclude that it is technically possible to achieve the rapid changes required to avoid 2.7 degrees of warming, they concede that it may be politically unlikely. And then, of course, in late November, the second National Climate Assessment Report, strangely mandated by Congress, another Congress, another time, and actually released by the White House, of course, on Black Friday. So they thought it wouldn't get much notice, but it did. Anyway, it was a report by 13 federal agencies presented the starkest warning to date of the consequences of climate change for the United States, I guess focusing on the economic damage that if significant steps are not taken, everybody always says that, the damage will knock as much as 10% off the size of the American economy by century's end, which in of itself not really a bad thing, because we actually need to stop the economic engine that is destroying us, because it is fueled by fossil fuels, as we know. And the idea that we can actually get off and transition to green energy, so-called green energy, is itself something that we need to take a much deeper look at, especially as the idea of the Green New Deal is actually now being taken seriously. The one promoted initially by a newly elected representative, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez from New York. So there's a lot to think about, and I hope people are able to think about it, because we need to do not just a lot of thinking, we need to act. But how do we act? Because there's a lot of difference between, say, a Green New Deal and an international revolution to overthrow the capitalist system. Can they work together? I don't know. Can capitalism save the climate? There's people who say it can. There's people who say it can't. I would argue that an awful lot rides upon coming to some sort of conclusion about that. And how do you come to a conclusion? Well, I'd like to hear what you all have to say. 503-231-8187. Of course, another thing that just happened is the 24th Conference of the Parties, which again began with the 1992 Rio de Janeiro Earth Summit, which brought the whole issue of sustainability and, well, really, the greenhouse effect climate crisis really came out big time during that event. And it set in motion the series of conferences of the parties, which is all the nations of the world getting together to address not just the climate crisis. There's also biodiversity conventions that came out of this, a number of international conferences on these major burning issues facing the planet. But of course, they just get bogged down in the inability of the rich countries to come to some agreement with the not so rich countries, with the heavy, heavy corporate influence on these events. If you go to these events, apparently there's just massive corporate presence in terms of lobbyists, in terms of their big booths, their huge presence. It's almost like a world's fair, another opportunity to hawk their products. Because, of course, only the corporations can have solutions. So let me read a little bit from another thing that just came out yesterday by the excellent, I think one of the foremost journalists on the climate crisis, Robert Hunsaker, who writes a lot for Counterpunch and other places, is COP24, one more big bust. 200 nations at Katowice, COP24, Poland, just wrapped up 2 weeks of climate meetings. If history is a guide, CO2 emissions will continue to accelerate until COP25 next year in Chile. Still, the delegates did adopt a rule book to put Paris 15 into action. But hark, there's a ray of sunshine peering out from behind the Katowice, I don't know how you pronounce that Polish city's name, coal-clouded skyline, because big money interests may be altering the landscape for combating global warming. According to reports out of Katowice, for example, Damian Carrington's The Guardian article, dated December 9, tackle climate or face financial crash, say world's biggest investors. Global investors managing $32 trillion issued a stark warning that the world faces financial Armageddon, worse than 2008, if carbon emissions are not cut, including a phase out of coal. Wow. That sets the stage for proving or disproving the old maxim, money talks. If it does, there's a glimmer of hope for Miami's survival. Accordingly, some of the world's deepest pocket investors, including pension funds, insurers, and asset fund managers, exhibited their most impressive intervention ever by insisting that fossil fuel subsidies must end, and two, substantial taxes must be slapped on carbon. According to the IMF, current subsidies for fossil fuels amount to $5 trillion per year, which makes fossil fuel subsidies alone equivalent to some of the largest economies in the world. Ipso facto, if $5 trillion a year pivots from fossil fuel subsidies to renewable investments, just imagine the impact. By way of comparison, 2017 total investment in renewables reached $280 billion. Of course, the big money interests would also be feathering their own nest by switching fossil fuel subsidies to renewables as the world economy accelerates with the thrust of a space shuttle blastoff, creating jobs, jobs, and more jobs in the renewable global economy. I don't know if that's Robert being a little ironic or if he's letting his optimism get away with him. Thus, a whole new world opens to massive infrastructure investments, accelerating global wealth creation as the world turns clean, assuming it's not too late by the time they get serious, a big assumption indeed. And that goes for our own very ambitious and noble mini Green New Deal that was passed here in Portland, mandating a assessment on large corporations to fund alternative energy projects and especially help the most economically disadvantaged communities to do so, and thus building trying to build a virtuous circle of investment and community-based organizing. I think that's the model that a lot of people hope can be extended to state, national, international levels. And with this Green New Deal, which again, I'll read a little bit because it comes right off of this article by Robert Hunsaker. So the day after, this is continuing with his article, the day after the closing of COP24, Mexico announced plans to spend $3.65 billion to boost crude oil production 45% by 2025. This is comparable to stabbing COP24 in the eye with a sharp stick. Nothing mentioned about renewable energy. And that's with the new supposedly leftist president. Although, I don't know, I don't know. But anyway, that's not good. And, well, I can't read this whole thing, but it goes on, and it's important to read. Is COP24 one more big bust? Found that on Counterpunch, dated yesterday by Robert Hunsaker. So, okay, let me go to this, before we, you know, get deep into this issue of capitalism versus the climate. Can capitalism save us, or must capitalism go? Do people even, I mean, what is capitalism? It's such a taboo topic that you'll never hear on almost any other radio station or on any cable station. Even the ones we think are actually, you know, confronting major issues of the day. There's been such the idea of political economy, the idea that, you know, drove the, anti-capitalist revolutions and even the social welfare state, which was forced because of the major presence of anti-capitalist political parties in Europe and other countries. In the United States, that was so thoroughly almost eliminated because of McCarthyism and just a deep culture and a, you know, reaction to the 60s by the Heritage Foundation and the other Republican billionaire-funded think tanks, which took as its task the dismantling of the challenges to capitalist racist patriarchy by the challenge of the 1960s. Capitalism, as I say, is such a taboo subject that I despair that we even have any kind of common understanding, even amongst people who listen to KABU, people who vote the progressive Democratic platforms, Bernie Sanders. I despair that even we have any kind of a common understanding of what capitalism actually is. Well, we can talk about that. 503-231-8187. I know I'm kind of going all over the place, but I'm trying to stick to the general theme of capitalism versus the climate. these major reports that have come out in the last 6 months, the ongoing massive climatic events happening because of climate change, from megafires to super hurricanes, droughts, massive rain events in a short period of time, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, in every crisis, there hopefully is a response, and there is more and more of a response because more and more people are starting to see it and not just turn away. Okay, so this is an article by Ellen Brown of the Public of Banking Movement. This is, came out on Monday on Common Dreams. This radical plan to fund the Green New Deal just might work. A network of public banks could fund the Green New Deal in the same way President Franklin Roosevelt funded the original New Deal. And I'll say this kind of goes along, you know, if a few years ago, Bill McKibben and some others started talking about this idea of a climate mobilization on the scale of, you know, World War II mobilization or, say, the New Deal. It's probably a better example, actually, because it is not like a wartime economy, because as we know, nation states do a lot better going to war and mobilizing on the basis of war than on the basis of mobilizing against other sorts of existential threats like climate change. Okay, so with what Naomi Klein calls, quote, galloping momentum, the Green New Deal promoted by newly elected Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Democrat in New York, appears to be forging a political pathway for solving all the ills of society and the planet in one fell swoop. Well, let's not get carried away here. It would give a House Select Committee, quote, a mandate that connects the dots between energy, transportation, housing, as well as health care, living wages, a jobs guarantee, and more. But to critics, even on the left, it is just political theater, since, quote, everyone knows a program of that scope cannot be funded without a massive redistribution of wealth and slashing of other programs, notably the military, which is not politically feasible. I would ask, why is it not politically feasible? Anyway, quote, every hyperinflation in history has been caused by foreign debt service collapsing the exchange rate. The problem almost always has resulted from wartime foreign currency strength, not domestic spending. Perhaps, but Ocasio-Cortez and the 22 representatives joining her in calling for a select committee are also proposing a novel way to fund the program, one which could actually work. The resolution says funding will primarily come from the federal government, quote, using a combination of the Federal Reserve, a new public bank, or system of regional and specialized public banks, public venture funds, and such other vehicles or structures that the select committee deems appropriate in order to ensure that interest and other investment returns generated from public investments made in connection with the plan will be returned to the Treasury, reduce taxpayer burden, and allow for more investment. I see that we've got one caller, Karen, but hold on. Let me just get another paragraph or two into this. A network of public banks could fund the Green New Deal in the same way President Franklin Roosevelt funded the original New Deal. At a time when the banks were bankrupt, he used the publicly owned Reconstruction Finance Corporation as a public infrastructure bank. The Federal Reserve could also fund any program Congress wanted if mandated to do it. Congress wrote the Federal Reserve Act and can amend it. Or the Treasury itself could do it without the need even to change any laws. The Constitution authorizes Congress to, quote, coin money and, quote, regulate the value thereof. And that power has been delegated to the Treasury. It could mint a few trillion-dollar platinum coins, put them in his bank account, and start writing checks against them. What stops legislators from exercising these constitutional powers is simply that, quote, everyone knows Zimbabwe-style hyperinflation will result. But will it? Compelling historical precedent shows that this need not be the case. Michael Hudson, professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, has studied the hyperinflation question extensively. He writes that those disasters were not due to government money printing to stimulate the economy. Rather, quote, every hyperinflation in history has been caused by foreign debt service collapsing the exchange rate. The problem almost always has resulted from wartime currency strains, not domestic spending. I think I read that before, and it was actually like a poll quote in the middle of the article. It wasn't meant to be read at the time. Sorry for that confusion. As long as workers and materials are available and the money is added in a way that reaches consumers, adding money will create the demand necessary to prompt producers to create more supply. Supply and demand will rise together and prices will remain stable. The reverse is also true. If demand money is not increased, supply and GDP will not go up. New demand needs to precede new supply. And then she goes on to explore in greater depth this public bank option, the precedent of Roosevelt's New Deal. And then she talks about the central bank option, how Japan is funding Abenomics with quantitative easing, and then finishes by filling the gap between wages, debt, and GDP. This is a, you know, four-page article that I can't read all of because I'm already reading a lot. But it's fascinating. It's, again, just 2 days ago, Ellen Brown came out on Common Dreams. This radical plan to fund the Green New Deal just might work. You know, and it takes reading these on your own and thinking about them and getting about together with other people to hopefully make what I'm trying to do here be a little more effective, which is to cite these things and get people thinking, reading, stimulating things. Before I get to that article, which may call into question some of the things you've just heard by calling into question the ability to do any of these things within a capitalist framework. Again, that's by Simon Pirani, his article just out on Truthout, which I'll read a little bit from in a bit. But let's go to Karen. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Oh, good morning, Paul. Thank you. My goodness. Well, these are gigantic topics and require lots of thought. I wanted to get back to something simple, which is, it's not so simple, but why is it that capitalism is not the answer to the climate crisis? And I wanted to look at that from the point of view of how it contributes. And you touched on some of it, and I may have missed some of it, but I wanted to just point out that the military that serves this capitalist system is the biggest producer of greenhouse gases, the U.S. military, and that the system of capitalism itself, which is about owners and workers at the most basic level, it's about workers not getting the benefit of their work, not getting compensated adequately for the benefit of their work, and not having any control over the system. And the system works by almost like a shark swimming. It has to keep getting fed with higher and higher profits because of the competition that's built into it. This is how I understand it anyway. Anybody can challenge me, but this is just an old person's reflection on the system. So it also goes for short-term benefit. And short-term benefit is driven by that competitive those competitive forces in the culture, so that you get killed, in quotation marks, as a capitalist if you don't keep producing more, better, whatever. And of course, there's lots of scams and deception and so forth, so it's not always better. But those forces pushing and at the cheapest cost, so that means you use the fossil fuels immediately, or that the fossil fuel interests drive forward more and more fossil fuel consumption and have captured the political apparatus to do that. And I don't now. Okay, that's part of one side of the argument. The other side of the argument has to do with how do you incentivize continual production of new good ideas like this Green New Deal? And the details are beyond my grasp without studying them, so I've no way to comment on financing and such. But what I do think happened in the Soviet Union and China, and by the way, one of the main reasons, not the only, but one of the main reasons that political opposition developed towards so-called communism, it wasn't communism, the workers weren't in control, a bureaucracy was in both countries, was because of the number of people who were killed. You had tens of millions of people killed in those systems, so that's not a good thing.
No. Yeah. I'm glad we agree on that.
Okay. So there's one of the things about capitalism is that it has a way of producing innovation. And so I do like the deal. I do like the idea of a sort of Manhattan Project for the production of ideas. And I don't think this system is conducive to easy changes and easy fixes.
Yeah, that's for sure.
No, and I've been a democratic socialist for decades and decades, you know, since I was in my early 20s. So I've thought a lot about means of production and workers' incentives and workers' rights and workers getting just economic compensation for what they do. So I think it's great that Ocasio-Cortez and people like her are pushing new ideas. And let's face it, the old ideas and the old system isn't going to work anyway. It's just taking us more and more into collapse. And so we have to try new ideas. And there will be failures and there will be successes, God willing. I don't know.
Well, you know, one thing that just came into mind as you're speaking and I'm listening to it, is that, you know, essentially what this Green New Deal is an inch. It's kind of a hybrid thing because it's clearly not coming out of, I mean, it is and isn't coming out of capitalism, because the idea, the hypocrisy that capitalism actually, that there is anything like, quote, free markets,
right,
and that capitalism has ever existed separate from, you know, the state companies, the national companies, the English land companies that initiated it, that's ever been separate from some sort of central state force. That's a total illusion. They like to have it both ways, the so-called free marketeers. And so this is just sort of making it, bringing it out in the open, as Roosevelt did when the system was, you know, he basically convinced the bankers and others, the big interest, to go along with the New Deal, because he told them he was saving capitalism, which may not have ultimately been a great thing. So yeah, this Green New Deal is basically making it explicit that there's always some sort of state intervention, and so this is just saying that the state actually needs to intervene, because or we're basically all going to die.
Yes, right. It's free market in quotation marks for the capitalists. That basically means that they have free range to kill and brutalize and rape the earth and whatever they want to do. It doesn't mean that the workers are free. It doesn't mean that women and people of color and indigenous peoples have any freedom or any rights. So, yeah, and there will be, as we know, tremendous pushback as we attempt to save the biosphere. But you know, we don't have a choice. You know, if there will be any survival for anybody and for the children and the animals and we need all the species to survive, as many as we can. It's a net. It's a web of life, and it's interdependent. The more that we have, capitalism loves to trim down the varieties in a plant species for efficiency. And then what happens, instead of hundreds of varieties that could maybe resist pests or diseases, you end up with two or three. And then you have something like Dutch elm disease, which will take out an entire variety.
Yeah, it's an application of the scientific reductionist model.
Yeah, that's right.
So
so, Paul, I just keep going back to what Jacqueline said last week about needing to understand this is another dimension, the sacredness of the earth and of the white buffalo calf woman, I think she called the spirit of the earth in one of the native traditions, that there's no sacredness in capitalism except dollar. That's all. So I've said enough, and these are complicated topics. They're hard to talk about on the radio, but I'm really, really grateful that you bring them up and that Jacqueline raises the points she raises. We desperately need this. Thank you so much,
okay.
And I did contribute. contribute to your program. Thank you, Paul.
All right. Well,
Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you for that. That wasn't necessary to say on the air, but I do appreciate that. That's a nice thought. Okay, so, let's just go to Thomas, next up in queue. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi, Paul. I heard you make a comment, or you quoted somebody, saying that the COP meeting in Poland was a bust, but I don't agree with that. Now, most of the suits, you know, those suits up there blathering away, yeah, you can't even bother to listen to that practically, but what stood out was that young girl, Greta Thunberg, from Sweden, who addressed that group and told these guys where to get off. And she told them, and she met with the head of that group, I don't know his name or the group's name, but she told him, I heard her say this, that, look, you guys have been working on this for 25 years and you have done nothing. And she says, the politicians will do nothing. You aren't going to do anything. And so what she did was, couldn't get her friends to go along with it, she went on strike. She stopped going to school. And this really drew the attention of the media in Sweden to the point where they told her to get away from the parliament buildings and said she was endangering herself, you know, so for her own safety, don't bring attention like this. And my point is that it's good. Okay, we can sit here and intellectualize all this stuff and have all these ideas of all this kind of stuff. And here, a little kid goes and, man, what an effect they had to draw attention. And there's people all over the world doing this now. The kids I know in Australia are staging strikes every Friday. It's amazing, you know, what she did. And here's another thing they asked her. This was really great. They asked her, well, Greta, can you give us some hope? You know, come on, Greta, give us some hopium. We need hope. And she said, well, hope is good. She said, that's good. She said, but look it, you have to act without hope. You can't use hope as an excuse not to act. And you when you start acting, the hope will come. The hope will come from your actions. And this is my last point. So here is my acid test for people wanting to do something. It is, you've brought up something, you said it was a taboo. This is a bigger taboo, because I've heard this mentioned on KBOO, and boom, oh boy, here comes the opposition. But veganism, if people could be a vegan for one day a week, for one meal, okay, you bring this up, and people shrivel away. They don't want to hear that. They don't want to give up their lifestyle. They don't want to make any changes. They want the magic of technology to save them from losing their lifestyle. And we can't support that with windmills and solar panels. You just can't do it. It's the physics of the thing or something like that, you know. So
okay,
to me, there are answers there, but a lot of people don't want to look at them.
Okay, well, thank you. I think actually Simon Pirani, the person I mentioned, who I actually haven't gotten to talk about his article or book yet, he has a very interesting take on that, basically by saying that that the fossil fuel consumption is so embedded in the social and economic systems that something like, you know, meat consumption is actually a very complex thing. So anyway, I really can't get into it in the last really 8 minutes here, but I'd encourage people to read this article, "Until We Confront Capitalism, We Will Not Solve the Climate Crisis," which came out 2 or 3 days ago. An interview by Anton Warrensuk in Truthout, interview with, again, Simon Pirani. And he does address the meat-eating thing, but I only have a little time left. I wanted to get to this Green New Deal, how he responds to that. So anyway, the question is, a widely celebrated proposal for a Green New Deal has been touted by many center-left politicians, including Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Bernie Sanders, and Yanis Varoufakis, as a solution to the multiple crises we face today. What is your evaluation of it? Quote, the Green New Deal appears to have several meanings. It has been used by mainstream neoliberal politicians to describe an investment program operated completely through markets that would shift the economy away from fossil fuels. The left-wing politicians you mentioned see the Green New Deal as a program of state infrastructure investment, a mobilization of resources on the scale of a war effort. Whether such a war-type mobilization would ever be implemented in any significant capitalist country remains to be seen. The political scientists Jeff Mann and Joel Wainwright suggest in their book Climate Leviathan that there could be an international agreement between the U.S., China, and others that would undertake such spending, but very much in the strongest country's neo-imperial interests, and with a big dose of geoengineering. Obviously, the left politicians' perspectives are quite different. In Burning Up, that's his new book, I argued that not just a social democratic spending program, but a much deeper going shift to post-capitalist social relations could provide the context for the fundamental changes in social, economic, and technological systems that will be necessary to break the economy's many-sided dependence on fossil fuels. That's how I see the future. By saying that, I don't deny the need for immediate responses. But the most noticeable immediate responses will come from governments. If anyone tells me they are up to the job of dealing with climate change, I would point to the fact that annual global fossil fuel consumption has risen by more than 60% since the Rio Convention was signed. Again, that was in 1992. That's the result of government's response. Australian school pupils understand that simple arithmetic better than they understand politicians' promises. This goes to Thomas's point just made now, which is why they, excuse the paper ruffling, went on strike and protest in inaction on climate change. They will not be the last ones of their generation to do so. I want to see, you know, young people combining, you know, resistance to schools and awareness, deep-seated awareness to school shootings that their generation has, you know, the awareness and the resistance is growing with a climate change movement. I would love to see that. The youth climate lawsuit is still making its way. It's unclear where it's going, but I'll be talking about that also in the new year. It's our Children's Trust. You might consider supporting them at the end of the year. That's one plug. I could give you others, but our Children's Trust is carrying on that really landmark lawsuit, basically to force a climate action plan, you know, possibly along the lines of the Green New Deal. There are a lot of converging things going on at a local level, like here in Portland, with the resistance to new fossil fuel infrastructure that's been going on in the Northwest, with this Green New Deal. There's a lot of intersecting things that hopefully we will make intersect in an even greater way and start, I hope, doing more direct actions against, say, these big private equity firms that fund things like tar sands pipes, like pipelines, tar sands equipment, like the megalodes that were going on 5 or 6 years ago. A lot of these in private capital investment is what's driving the fossil fuel economy. It's basically a pyramid scheme such that they have to keep taking the stuff out of the ground in order to pay back their previous investments, or, you know, bundle mortgages or privatize water or whatever. That's the nature of the capitalist system. It has to keep finding the new big sources of capital investment, and it's do or die for them. So how can a capitalist or non-capitalist effort like the Green New Deal, how can it take the place of these massive private capital funds that are driving the global capitalist economy? Well, hopefully I'll have some people on next year who know a lot more about that than me, like this Simon Pirani. Again, I just picked up this new book just out in this year called Burning Up, A Global History of Fossil Fuel Consumption. He kind of comes at this. He was a scholar on the Soviet Union and the breakup of the Soviet Union and the massive fossil fuel development of post-Soviet Russia and how that influences geopolitics, Putin and all. Very fascinating, very interesting guy. Again, he wrote this book, He's featured in this interview, "Until We Confront Capitalism, We Will Not Solve the Climate Crisis." Of course, there's other articles from mostly neoliberal or conservative free market, so-called free marketeers, who do say that only capitalism can fix climate change. Corey Morningstar, who I've had on this program, has actually accused big groups like 350.org and Bill McKibben as at best vacillating on the question of basically implicitly going along with the idea that only big shifts within capitalism, within the capitalist classes, you know, whether it's the insurance companies or big investment funds, only they can solve the climate crisis. It's a huge question, and a lot rides on it. So I hope more people get thinking about it, and that's what I'm going to be talking a lot about in the new year. And we are just about out of time. Maybe we'll go out with a little more of our theme song from Danbert, No Bacon, and the Axis of Dissent, To Be or Not to Be. I want to thank my engineer, Heather. Thank those of you called. I know I read a lot today. There wasn't necessarily a lot of space for calling in, but maybe next week we'll have more calls in. Thank you all very much for listening. I'm Paul Rowe, and this is Wednesday Talk Radio. Talk to you next week.
To be or not to be, to be or not to be.
Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows and reaper drones of those who make outrageous fortunes from the suicide bomb of fossil fuel.
To be.
To hide when the whole planet is a sacrifice zone for the 1% in their green zones.
To be or not to be, to be or not to be.